Hello and welcome to Millions of Screens. I'm creative producer Leo Garcia, joined via Zoom by TVW editor Ben Travers and TV Awards editor Libby Hill. Today, we're going to be talking about the best place to start a show. The beginning? We'll also be talking about the SAG Awards, which occurred on Sunday. A quick Falcon and Winter Soldier update. And Corgi Corner. Although not talking about The Crown, talking about Bridgerton. Some Bridgerton news.
This is the millions and millions of little screens.
Can't you shut up? I'm busy. Boy, what a great show.
Skipping ahead to the clicker, our recap of the biggest news items from this past week. Libby, the SAG Awards were Sunday night. Well, they weren't actually Sunday night, but some version of them occurred Sunday night on TNT and TBS. As we talked about leading into the week, we didn't think there was going to be a lot of surprises, and guess what? There weren't a lot of surprises. The one that the one TV one that kind of surprised me, and I wanted to get both of your thoughts on this, because I do think Ben would have strong thoughts, is Mr. Jason Bateman in Best Actor in a Drama Series. Ben?
That was incredibly exciting to see Jason Bateman get the recognition that he deserved. And in true Jason Bateman fashion, he immediately rattled off like all of the go-to thank yous very quickly. Netflix, fellow cast members, MRC, all that fun stuff. And then
MRC.
And then shifted to everybody go get your vaccines. This is for the essential workers out there. Like just completely moving away from himself. Just like he does when you try to talk to him about acting, he's like, no, I can't do it anymore. I can only talk about like the show or other things around the show. So that was really fun to experience. And yeah, great. Very proud that he beat Josh O'Connor. I think it's deserved.
With no winner at the forefront of this that can't compete in the Emmys, do you just have to hang on to all the other wins that Josh O'Connor has had leading into the Emmys?
Like you do, but I don't think that he has so much heat. Like if anything... I mean, I guess it could go one of two ways. They could go through their ballots and just be like, crown, 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 crown. And he gets swept in a wave, which I assume happened with Schitt's Creek last year. Or, and I think this is more likely, they get to that category and they're like, is there someone I like better than this guy? Because it isn't such a standout performance. I'm wondering, you know, why not give it to Sterling K. Brown again? Because no matter what you think of his show, he's always... why not give it to someone whose performance you love, even if it's on a show you don't love? That is where my gut trends with Josh O'Connor. I think he was great this year, but I don't know that it was the best performance on television. So, you know, good for Jason Bateman. I strongly suspect he was in second place at the Emmys this year because I think Ozark probably was second place in a lot of categories at the Emmys last year. I'm sorry, Ben, like I know that sounds like damning with faint praise, but
it was
up against Succession,
right? Absolutely.
So yeah, that was my feeling. Like most of the surprises at the SAGs really came on the film side. I will tell you, the most interesting win for me was Gillian Anderson. Gillian Anderson was competing in drama series because SAG doesn't do supporting actor series for television for whatever reason, categories. Gillian Anderson beat out both Olivia Colman and Emma Corrin, both of whom will be competing at the Emmys in lead. With her supporting performance, which suggests to me that, you know, that is the go-to performance from The Crown that people are really behind, which I wouldn't have guessed. I would have guessed most of the heat was behind Corrin. So that was an interesting, you know, minuscule adjustment of the equilibrium to me.
I will say, probably not surprising, but this was the first quote-unquote head-to-head battle that Anya Taylor-Joy and Michaela Cole had in any award space, and Queen's Gambit came out on top as it has in the awards where she has sort of been uncontested, as it were.
Yeah, That said, there are still outstanding limited series coming on the pike, but at this point, we're not seeing a lot of movement for Small Axe outside of John Boyega. I May Destroy You isn't getting as much heat, and Cole isn't getting as much heat as I had really hoped. One nice thing is we know the cast of I May Destroy You will be recognized at the Film Independent Spirit Awards, because with the introduction of TV categories, they have like an ensemble category that was given rather than voted on. And I believe they announced with the nominations that that was going to I May Destroy You, which is good. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of show I want to see the Independent Spirit Awards lifting up. But yeah, it was disappointing, but I think it's something we need to start reconciling ourselves with. Queen's Gambit has really cemented itself as nearly untouchable through this winter TV Awards season, but another limited series that we thought did that at the time was Escape at Dannemora. And by the time the Emmys came around, that had gotten stripped for parts, basically. So a lot can change. I don't know if it will, but it could.
Ben, do you want to talk about Falcon and Winter Soldier at all?
Do I? Only every day, Leo. There's a couple of guys trying to save the world, I think, and couple they of banter.
Dudes. Yeah, there's a lot of banter.
They haven't kissed yet, but I really do feel like every time I tune in that it's going to happen this week. Like that this...
Ben...
is the week.
Ben, I want to thank you for bringing up the kiss, because it only reminds me that I didn't gloat the past couple of weeks for nailing when they would first meet up in episode two. We're not doing phrases anymore?
Kudos to both of you, Libby, for the great joke, and Leo for nailing it. That was... an impeccable understanding of the structure of Marvel. Definitely does not speak at all to understanding, you know, the format through multiple hours, if not days, if not weeks, spent absorbing their content and thus breaking it down to the minute by minute shifts.
It's actually a little
frightening. Is my brain broken from having ingested so much Marvel? Yeah, sure. But it allows me to make a predictive guesses, like they will meet on screen in the 7th minute of the 2nd episode and be absolutely right about it.
There's got to be some kind of really insular niche betting site on the internet where you can bet on stuff like that and probably make a lot of money.
WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier share a lot in that I don't think either of them quite know how to be television. Are they entertaining? Yeah. In fits and spurts, but I do think that like they are still struggling with what it means to be a television series in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, I will say, is it feels so comfortable in being a buddy cop procedural type show that it's almost like my mind is grafting that onto the show even when it doesn't exist. Like, I kind of struggled with the 3rd episode because it didn't quite fit in the way that I wanted it to fit. I was like, okay, they're going to go get this guy. He's going to take him to this place, and that's going to be the thing that happens this week, and that's how we define the episode, and that gives it kind of its own unique stamp and puts it at its own like kind of, you know, easy to understand episodic framework, and it works, and it's TV, and I got it. And it didn't quite do that, especially with the way that it ended in the midst of kind of an adventure where I was like, whoa, this isn't the right time to end it. This is a cliffhanger ending, but it's not really, it didn't wrap up as much as it should have to be a complete episode. So I think that Falcon of the Winter Soldier could very easily slide into a more understandable, more familiar TV structure if it wanted to. It just seems to be resisting it because, again, like you said, I don't know if they want to make TV or if they just want to make content to fill a certain amount of time at this point. So
I will say I'm on the positive end of the Falcon and Winter Soldier, but I will caveat that with they have set a lot of stuff up over the course of these first 3 episodes, and I fear that that's just like that we're forgetting about, like, forget Sam's bank loan. Forget they Sam's do. Family.
They have to get back to that. They have to come back around to that.
Forget Isaiah Bradley and the fact that he was the black Captain America. All you have to know is the fact that they used his blood to create a super soldier serum. And I worry that they've spread themselves very thin in terms of having all these things that you kind of want to see some kind of completion on. I mean, you want to see a resolution to these plot threads.
I do take comfort in the fact that they released a photo of Sebastian Stan and Anthony Mackie on Sam's boat. So, like, they're together on the boat from the first episode. So, at some point, that boat is coming back around, and Bucky's going to help out with it. And it's like, cool, that sounds great. I don't know if I'm investing too much in a photo released before the first episode aired, but hey, that's where we are right now. And honestly, like, the weird thing to me, and I think this just makes me a very terrible human being, as well as a terrible TV watcher. I'm way more on board with Falcon and the Winter Soldier than WandaVision in terms of talking about it as television, because it really doesn't, it just doesn't feel like it's trying as hard. Like, WandaVision felt like it had an ambition behind it that I wanted to see it fulfill, and the fact that it didn't fulfill that ambition became very frustrating to me as the episodes continue to roll out. Whereas Falcon and the Winter Soldier to me feels like, okay, this is just like straight Marvel. We're gonna give it to you. We're not gonna hide it behind anything. Just take it and enjoy it. And I'm like, fine, I'm not gonna question anything. I'm just gonna have fun with it. And it's just gonna be turn your brain off TV. And I'll read some of the stuff that comes out, especially at IndieWire.com, where we have a wonderful writer reviewing each and every episode. But otherwise, I'm just going to, that's it. That's as far as I'm going to go with it. Whereas I feel like WandaVision wanted me to invest more. And because I did invest more at the onset and was disappointed, it hurts. It hurts more looking back, even though objectively I think WandaVision is better. Here we are. I've arrived at the crux of my
awfulness.
Yep.
You made it all the way around on this point of view. I think I was, in anticipation of talking about Falcon and Winter Soldier, I definitely... A phrase that has entered my mind is like, it knows exactly what it is, and it's not trying to be something else. Where I think WandaVision was trying to be maybe a little bit more than was under the surface. But stylistically, you could say what you want about like how wide or the various very serious topics that Falcon and Winter Soldier is taking on in this comic book narrative. Not that WandaVision wasn't also taking on grief and loss in some ways, but. You know, the racial inequity and systematic racism in this country. But at its heart, it's like, as you said, Ben, it is Sam and Bucky just bantering, hanging out together, not really liking each other. Like, that's really all you need. Yeah, it's like, just fucking around. Like, we got to, like, I don't like you that much, but we got to solve this crime. All right, let's go solve the crime.
It actually, ooh, sorry, go ahead, Ben.
No, I got about halfway through Captain America and the Winter Soldier before Falcon and the Winter Soldier started. And I watched the most recent episode, and then I started at the halfway point of the movie after the most recent episode ended. And one of the first things I saw was Bucky kicking a guy into a jet engine. And I was just like, oh, wow, we've come a long way from this evil, malicious murderer to the guy who I just want to see sit in couples therapy and figure his shit out. Like, I don't know if we earned that journey. I don't know if like it's fully there or whatever.
He spent a couple years in Wakanda. Sure, he got all the bad stuff out of his brain. Nearly got the Infinity Stone out of Vision's head. She's amazing. She let Martin Freeman walk again.
That's kind of how it worked for me. I spent a couple of years in Wakanda, like just watching Black Panther, and I was like, ooh, this is good shit. I can get behind this. And I mean,
when I was doing my rewatch, that was one of the things that I took away. It was like, Bucky kills a lot of people. And I think the show tries to rectify that early on. Like when they do show that flashback, like he kills an innocent just because he's in the wrong place at the wrong time. And
well,
that's who he was.
I have many points to make in this argument. First of all, it actually handles that so much better than WandaVision. At the end of WandaVision, it's not necessarily about the people Wanda has killed, but the people whose basically mines. She's broken and she's held hostage for over this period of time and basically mentally tortured. And they're like, well, I get it. I get why you did it. And then Wanda goes
off.
You were sad.
So you force all these people to relive their most traumatic memory constantly.
I can relate. And then she goes, she fucks off Dexter style and goes to some cabin in the woods, which is fine. Whereas in...
That's the meanest thing anyone has ever said about WandaVision is referring to it as Dexter style.
Fucks off Dexter style.
And then Falcon and Winter Soldier were actually engaging in that. You know, what does it do to your brain to have been turned into a weapon? And how do you deal with surviving when so many of the people you encountered did not? Also, I do think that my favorite thing about Falcon and Winter Soldier is that it is built around this, one of my favorite TV tropes, which is how are two ancillary friends, how do they relate when their connecting friend is gone? Seinfeld did this with like Elaine and George, like trying to be in a room together when Jerry wasn't there and how awkward it is. And that is like the underlying dynamic of this entire series, and I love it. Who are Sam and Bucky when their best friend is gone forever? And do they have enough in common without Steve to actually build a relationship? I love it.
Of any big comedic ensemble, it's always fun to see the two people that shouldn't be in a room together be in a room together, and that's sort of what you're getting here every episode. Though they are building some budding.
And I will say it in comparison to, like, if you're comparing kind of Wanda's journey in WandaVision to what Bucky's going through here, a lot of our acceptance of Bucky was earned in the movies that came before this, and now we're watching him deal with it more in the day-to-day, whereas WandaVision presented that same kind of idea where, like, she went through a bunch of shit before the series started, and this is the moment, like, this is the show where we're going to watch her process it, and that we didn't get enough of that was one of my greatest frustrations with the show. But then the ending where it invited a new set of kind of questions that I don't think it meant to, it just brings up that kind of that very Marvel take on serialization where instead of like locking everything down within this limited series, instead of like kind of buttoning up, you know, this story and saying, this is the story, this is the arc, there's always room to them to fix it later. Like, they can address those issues later on if they want to, and they already addressed a lot of that with Bucky. They had time, they had years and years of making those movies to kind of make sure to get that arc just right, and if something wasn't quite working after one movie, they can address it in the next movie, and then by the time we get here to this TV show, we're ready to see him, you know, wrestle with these things and try to figure out a path forward. And they may end up doing the same thing with WandaVision. We may look back at WandaVision in, you know, 3, 4, 5 years and say, okay, it set that up. That was a problem then, but they did address it later on, so you can't complain about it. And that's not really fair, but it is the Marvel way. So,
well, reverse engineering is, you know, is sort of the Marvel brand.
Retcon.
But the retcon. That was the word I was looking for. Thank you. And with Bucky, like, he's drugged for a lot of time. Like, they know he's not going to be able to process all of this, so he's doing all of that work off screen, off in Wakanda, off wherever. We don't know what that process looks like. Maybe it was just as painful and horrible as Wanda's. Maybe, I don't know. But of course, he was in Wakanda, so everything was better. This is not the meat of the show.
No, but we're going long on Falcon and Winter Soldier.
I love it.
At the risk of changing gears too abruptly, we have a very special edition of Corgi Corner, where our executive editor, Anne Donahue, is going to talk about some Bridgerton casting news.
Welcome to Corgi Corner, where we talk about shows that have big costumes and big houses. And this week, it's not The Crown, you guys. It's Bridgerton. There's been a little bit of Bridgerton drama over the past week. It was announced that Regé Jean Page, the standout of the first season, would not be returning for season 2. And the universal reaction is pretty much, what? Why? He's so hot. Why is he not going to be in season 2? Can you tell I'm actually from Southern California? I am, you guys. This is actually just true to the books. The backstory on this is that each book in the Bridgerton series is about a different sibling in the Bridgerton family. So book number 2 is The Viscount Who Loved Me. It is about the Viscount, Anthony Bridgerton, the eldest son who is played by Jonathan Bailey. Simon and Daphne's story really just kind of runs out after the first book. They make cameos. Sometimes they have their kids running through the room. Sometimes they drop by for a game of croquet. That's really it. So the next season, justifiably, won't have Regé-Jean in it. I think, honestly, it'll be okay once people get over the initial shock, because Kate Sharma, the character that plays Anthony Bridgerton's intended, is great. It's one of the Hall of Fame Bridgerton characters. Simone Ashley from Sex Education will be portraying her, and I think pretty much all your heartache will be assuaged by the second season when it comes out.
I teased it a little bit at the top of the show about when you should start a show or where you should start a show, tongue-in-cheek the beginning, but this has come to the forefront because HBO Max has released Made for Love, which Ben teased a couple of weeks ago, which starts in medias res. That's how I've always said it. How do you guys pronounce that?
Yeah,
in
I say in media res.
Like we grew up in the Midwest. That's how we pronounce it.
Right.
Oh, it's I say it like I'm Spanish.
It's like I'm about to say in some sort of resolution, like I'm talking about the picture quality of something, which in always makes me forget what it actually means. So this is a good conversation to remind me that when people use this term, they're not talking about how the picture looks on their television.
But this came up, Ben, because you shared IndieWire's sister site, Variety, Caroline Framke's review of Made for Love, which she talks about the fact that it uses this device of dropping us in the middle of the action and then flashbacking at the very next scene to time before where we have started the proceedings of the show.
Right. So this is a technique that is grown in prominence, and we've seen at least a tipping point in the minds of TV critics, because obviously Caroline's review is an excellent example of kind of the argument in full and how it applies to this specific show. But we've seen other people have been kind of complaining or citing that this trend is rising over the last weeks, months, if not, you know, years, really. And it usually stems from a desire to replicate something that succeeded. And, you know, Breaking Bad had a lot of success in kind of teasing something at the beginning of its season, if not throughout its season in the openings of episodes, where you were trying to figure out, okay, so this is the future. How are they going to get there? And it's also, as I think Caroline notes pretty early in the review, it's also typically encouraged for writers to start their show at an exciting incident, at a tipping point, at something kind of immediately engaging, so that you do not lose interest too quickly. And in the age of, you know, streaming and binging and too much TV, it's become something of a crutch for these shows to kind of start beyond the actual beginning of their story, so that they can kind of trick viewers into thinking that there's something more going on than meets the eye. And to me, Made for Love was such a good example of this. I mean, again, not to take away anything from Caroline's review, because it's perfect and laid it out much better than I had laid out. But when I watched that show and was reviewing it, pegged to South by Southwest, I wrote about 300 words related to this problem, and then realized I can't really get into this without, or I felt like I couldn't really get into it without spoiling something that hadn't come out yet. So I deleted it and kind of reframed. But the problem with Made for Love is that it stars Kristen Milioti. She is the wife of a tech billionaire played by Billy Magnuson. And the first thing you see in the show is actually an advertisement for the Made for Love chip, which is a chip that's implanted in couples' brains that actually allows them to share a mindset. So like you basically meld your minds together, so that there's no secret and there's no separation, and you're one unit moving forward, even though there's still two bodies walking around.
Codependence, the chip.
That's exactly it. And if you can imagine, there's problems that ensue. So you watch that advertisement, and then the next thing you see is Kristen Milioti crawling out of this basically a sewer grate in the middle of the desert. She's completely sopping wet, but she's wearing a like luminous green ball gown, and she's obviously very stressed and very relieved, and you see her kind of stand up and flip off this building out way, way, way in the background, the shining silver thing, and then we cut to 24 hours earlier to learn what happened and how she got there. And that in and of itself, it's annoying in the context of we've seen this so many times already. It's not that big of a tease. We can kind of already imagine why she needed to escape just from understanding the premise of the show. I feel like a lot of shows that shouldn't use this conceit, this in media res structure, often forget that people have watched the trailer for their show before they start watching it. So then they kind of already know some of the things that you're purportedly teasing. But Made for Love doubles down on this, and they use it again and again and again. They keep kind of jumping back and forth in time to try to tease things that don't necessarily need teasing. And for me, it undercut a lot of the more important discussions that this science fiction show wanted to have about codependency, about autonomy, about what's kind of sacrificed in a relationship when you completely give yourself over to another person. And it also just made it very hard for you to see more than the escaping woman's side of things. Like she clearly needed to escape, and there's no questioning why, and yet they kind of continue to make you want to do that for a little bit too long in the series. And I think that's the conversation that, like, hopefully more creatives and more people who are making TV are having these days. Like, I want them to just kind of discuss, when should you start the show, not in like a flash forward or flashback standpoint, but just what is the beginning of your show? Where do you want this thing to start? And why can't it start in a place that's exciting for audiences, and yet it doesn't, you know, make them, it doesn't give them a headache trying to keep up with where you are in the chronology of it all?
I mean, I have a lot of things to say about that too. But this is such a pet peeve for so many critics that I know. A couple weeks ago, Alan Sepinwall, the critic at Kissing Cousin organization Rolling Stone, wrote something very similar, pegged to Made for Love and Netflix's The Serpent, and I think AMC's Gangs of London, all of which are dealing with in media res openings. Something that Sepinwall writes is that he, over the years, has talked to a lot of TV creators who say they're getting pressure from networks in network notes to start all of their shows in very exciting places. And as most people who are somewhat familiar with narrative structure, a lot of stories don't naturally begin at the most exciting part because that's usually where you're headed to. And so it does feel a little bit like a cheat. And I really question that with pilots that are like, yeah, we're gonna get you right in there. But if I don't know what's going on and I don't know who the people are, that's false stakes. Like, I'm not actually invested in that. It's just confusing.
Yeah, especially with ongoing series, I feel like the importance of introducing your characters needs to take precedence at some point. Like, because you're going to be spending so much time with these people. If you don't understand why you're being asked to make that investment pretty early on, then it becomes a problem.
Right. It's also a strange choice to me because so many networks are wanting to soften things for audiences. They want to make sure everything is very clear. And yet they're pushing creators towards these openings where no one has any idea what's going on. The intent is to confuse, and you want to coast on that confusion into, you know, them watching more than 2 minutes of your show. And I understand that, and I understand the importance of those first minutes, especially when it comes to streaming. But it also, it's cheap. It's a cheap ruse, and audiences are getting wise to it. And I really struggle with choices that are made not to strengthen the narrative, but just to try and trick viewers. But also, I'm ostensibly a critic. I'm a journalist. I can have such moral quandaries, and creators a lot of times can't. But yeah, I do think this has a lot to do with a larger conversation too, which is, when are you starting your story? Are you starting your story too early? Are you starting your story too late? And if your story is actually made better by starting in that middle place and jumping backwards, do you need to jump backwards at all? Is that information we could get from you continuing your story from that very exciting place? Filling it in via flashback or whatever context. It's a conversation we've had before. It's a conversation we'll continue having, but it's just, it's something that I do wish I had the confidence to say more creators are paying attention to, as they're putting their shows together.
It seems like there's this weird balancing act between like, intense confusion, purposeful intense confusion that is supposed to create intrigue without becoming exhausting, because otherwise you're just like, what is I don't understand, like I'm over this show. And then,
as a slight defense for In Media Res, I do think that there is a tradition of this in TV. It's the cold open, where you will have a scene, generally an exciting scene, something to draw the audience in, and then you would go to credits. It would be self-contained, it would go to credits, and then the actual episode would begin. And that is, I think that the purpose of that was functioned very similar to In Media Res without necessarily having to play with the time. But I get the roots of it, I get the intent of it, I just don't know that it's being deployed properly at this juncture.
Ben, in the case of Made for Love, and this is something that I experienced while watching it, it's so high concept. Like, there's so much to digest in terms of the technological evolution of this world. It almost feels like you don't need that start, because you want to be able to understand the rules of the world before we start jumping back and forth.
Yeah, and honestly, it's a great point, because one of the things that really seems like kind of the obvious hook of that pilot episode is the twist at the end. Like, without spoiling anything, when we're talking about a Made for Love chip, and we're talking about a couple who already exists, and one is trying to escape something, you can probably guess a little bit about what may have happened that would make them want to run away. And because the pilot does seem geared toward reaching that revelation, and then the rest of the story is kind of based in what happens next, it seems like a very natural fit for you don't need to fuck around with it. You've already got so much world building you have to do. You already have a couple that you need to establish. You already have, certain things that just have to be laid out from a character standpoint and from a story standpoint so that people understand what's going on, that you don't need to screw with your timeline as well. And I think this was one of the things that I really struggled with, even as I was just taking notes watching the series, because there were a lot of pressing questions that I had that were eventually answered, that if they would have started at a different point, would have been answered sooner, and then my investment would have been stronger throughout the rest of what was going on. And to get into specifics would be getting into the spoiler territory, but it's also one of the frustrating things about a show like this, because this is a somewhat ambitious show. This is an HBO Max original series. There's a lot of very likable people like within it. So like the cast itself kind of makes you want to stick around just for that. And it could grow into something that was worth watching. Like, it could become a show that I really liked. And you see kind of the seeds of that in different places if you stick around long enough. And that's just another thing that makes the In Media Res opening kind of frustrating, because it just feels like it's too much work to get to the point where you want to give it a chance. And kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, Libby, I wanted to ask you if you had a similar reaction to this. And again, without spoiling, because I'm jumping the gun in terms of what's available for people, but the Mayor of Easttown pilot, to me, is almost like the opposite of this. The Mayor of Easttown pilot is very slow and very deliberate and lays all of the groundwork in terms of, like, here's this character, and here's what you need to know, and here's this character, and here's what you need to know. And there's, like, 12 characters. There's so many people in the show on purpose, and in part because it's a mystery that, Kate Winslet is trying to solve, which is really all the all the hook that you need. But that pilot really trusts the audience to stick with it. It really trusts them to say, like, you know, this is going to be a mystery. You know, this is going to get exciting. You know, this is going to be more than what we're showing you right at the beginning, but we're going to trust that you like the world, that you like the people, and that you're going to care about this to come back next week. And for me, that works really well. Like, I really like this pilot. Did you have a similar reaction? And is that a thing that only certain networks and certain executives and certain writers are going to trust people to do?
I think it's the thing only certain stories can do by certain executives at certain networks. When you have a mystery and it is, when you have a mystery series and it is led by one of the most famous actresses in the world, you have a little more leeway when you're telling your story. Because there is definitely a certain chunk of the audience that's going to watch no matter what. But the other thing they lean on, I think, is this. This is such a very specific part of the United States, one that definitely doesn't get depicted very often on TV. And all of the cast members, or all of the characters as such, are very unique and a little strange. And it's difficult to understand the dynamics at play. There are a lot of things that seem like contradictions, emotional relationships that are a little confusing. But it's very... it's very carefully laying out all the pieces for the mystery it is going to. I picture it as like the beginning of like a loom. Like you have all of the fabric, all of the material there, and the episodes to come are going to start like weaving them together. I think because audiences know how to watch mysteries, audiences, you know, are very familiar with this sort of pseudo true detective style show, that they know how to watch it. I can see where with Made for Love, there might be more concern about not knowing, not trusting that the audience is going to understand how to watch it. But I don't know. I liked what Mare of Easttown did. I don't think it's a luxury that every show has, but I do wish that more shows, Everything's on Fire in downtown LA. I do wish that more shows would have a little faith. I know why they don't, but I wish that they would err on that side. Again, Mare of Easttown's different because it's a limited series. You're not asking people to spend an hour investing in this universe that they may need to spend the next 60 hours in. So I think you have to move, you have to sell faster in recurring series, because you need to make it worth their time. If you invest in a limited series, it's like 7 hours max that you're going to have to spend there. And that's much less. I think people are more willing to give that leeway to fuck around.
Yeah, I guess what it comes down to for me is the line of thinking is basically a question of trust. Like you're saying, I think it's very easy to walk into a pitch and lay out a complicated structure and say, this is what's going to hook people. Like, we have literally designed this show so that in 2 minutes we'll hook you into a question and that's going to keep you moving forward. And that's exactly what executives, I imagine, would want to hear. They want to hear a somewhat kind of guarantee or some kind of assurance built into the show that they'll have you and the audience isn't going to go anywhere. And at the same time, I do think it's absolutely possible for you to get that hook with characters. I just think it's harder to explain to people how you're going to do it. So if you've got people who have done it before, I hope they just keep doing it. Like, I hope, and I, again, like you said, I hope the executives and whoever they're making this television with continue to trust them to do that, because I just think that's how great TV is made. I think you're going to have such a stronger reaction to the exciting incident if you see it happen in real time to people you're already invested in, as opposed to it's the first thing you see off the bat, and then you have to try to figure out, okay, why do I give a shit about this? So
I'm trying to remember what, like, the first scene of Mad Men is.
The first scene of Mad Men is Don in the bar.
Yeah, right? Like, that's not excited. That's just a dude talking to someone in the bar, like, trying to... Like, I don't know.
It does invite thought.
Oh, man.
Like, it's one of those things
now
where...
I want the poll to be, what's your favorite first scene of a show? That's not an easy poll. It's more like a question and answer. But, like, I do love the idea of, like, what is your favorite... Like, not your favorite pilot. Because, obviously, Friday Night Lights pilot is perfect.
That is true. We could come up with examples, though. Because, like, there's examples of... Like, Breaking Bad is an example of N-Media Res working. Mad Men is an example of something that requires a little more thought and patience. And then there's... I mean, there's... If you just go to the big ticket things, you know.
Yeah, what's Sopranos? Does he go to...
Is it Melfi?
That would make the most sense to me, but I don't know. And The Sopranos does start in Melfi's office.
Starts in Melfi's office. I was also opening HBO Max up. You referenced Manifest, Ben, but I think something we haven't talked about is how dangerous it is to start a show in medias res, because if you're a show like Flash Forward, we never find out where you went. We never found out. We don't know. What was it all about?
What?
Well, he was loaded, okay?
I don't understand. He was loaded, okay? Feelings of Screenings is a production of Penske Media Corporation and IndieWire. Our theme music features excerpts, the classic YouTube video Bjork talking about TV, and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Our editor-in-chief is Dana Harris-Brightson. Our publisher is James Israel. And our executive editor and host of Corgi Corner is Ann Donahue. Our favorite TV dogs.
Wow.
Our Santa's little helper from The Simpsons, Cheddar from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and Eddie from Frasier. Did you know that Eddie from Frasier is related to the dog from Beginners? IndieWire's Millions of Screens reminds you, they're not our dogs.
You'll get that after Doggy Bag, don't worry.
Oh, it's a Leftovers reference? Did I read it right? Did I do a good job on reading it?
You did a fine job. I was more impressed with how you read Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Millions of Screens reminds you, they're not our dogs. They're not our dogs. You can find us on Twitter at A Million Screens, at Midwest Spitfire, at Ben T. Travers, and at Leo Adrian Garcia. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play. So leave a review and let us know what you think. This is Ben. Libby and Leo remind you that you shouldn't let poets lie to you. And they're not our dogs.
You shouldn't let poets lie to you.
Ain't nothing wrong with a couple of cold brews and a cool podcast.